Yeah. Okay, so so now it's time for the cosmology. I'm going to be talking about the supernova legacy survey, and in particular the cosmological results from Type 1a supernovae that we're using to measure dark energy. At the same time, I'm also going to be talking a little bit about some of the connections with supernova 1a host galaxies, which we already heard about this morning as well. So just a word on the collaboration. It's primarily a Canadian and French collaboration. There's a group in Toronto, which is led by Ray Kahlberg, a group in Victoria, which is led by Chris Pritchett, who spoke this morning, and then there's a French group led by Renaud Pan. And we also have collaborators in the US and the UK who provide telescope time to the project.
Why are there only the French-speaking side?
Oh, no comments. Okay, so dark energy then. So why are we interested in dark energy? Well, this pie chart here shows the energy, the approximate energy composition of the universe. And what we know is that the universe is comprised of about 5% of ordinary baryonic matter. That's matter that makes up stars and planets and the Earth and us. About 22% is in the form of dark matter, which we don't know very much about at all. And then about 70% of the energy in the universe is in the form of dark energy, which we know even less about. And it's this dark energy that drives the cosmic acceleration that Type 1a supernovae were used to discover about 10 years ago. So how do we measure dark energy then? Well, we do this using a general relativity and the Friedman equation, which is a solution to general relativity. This equation here shows the expansion of the universe parameterized by this scale factor A. And this dark energy term, so there's three components. There's the matter component, which is the dark matter and baryonic matter. There's curvature. And then there's the dark energy term or component, which is parameterized by this omega x. And when we measure dark energy, we try to measure this W parameter, which is the equation of state of dark energy, and it's the ratio of the pressure to density. And how do we do this? Well, what we do is when we have a standard candle, we can measure the actual brightness, the distance to the standard candle, because the standard candles all have the same brightness, so we know how far away they are. And then by getting their redshifts or their scale factors, we can equate the two and we can solve the equation for omega x and w. So the possibilities are that w is equal to minus 1. That would mean that dark energy was constant everywhere in the universe. It's constant across space and time. That's the cosmological constant. And then there's either w is greater than minus 1 or w is less than minus 1. And the w greater than minus 1 is basically quintessence class models. W less than minus 1 is very unpopular with theorists, and it is phantom energy. And so the observational goal then is to determine W as a function of scale factor for the dark energy component. And you can ask these three questions. Firstly, is the average value consistent with minus 1? Then is W constant? And then finally, what is W as a function of the scale factor? And I'd say at the moment we're somewhere between these two goals, number 1 and number 2. So how do we do this? Well, we've seen this before, so I'll go over these slides very quickly. How do we make a standard candle out of Type 1a supernovae? Well, Type 1a supernovae have a range of light curve shapes and a range of brightnesses, but in general, the brightness of the supernova correlates with the width of the light curve, in the sense that brighter supernovae have wider light curves and fainter supernovae have narrower light curves. So this is the Phillips relation, and you can make an adjustment or correction to the peak magnitudes of the supernovae based on this light curve shape, and of course, you know, everything gets much better and all the supernova light curves line up with each other. So that's the first thing. And then there's some color relationship. Redder supernova tend to be fainter, and bluer supernova tend to be brighter. And you can make empirical corrections based on the color of the supernova, again, to correct for things like dust extinction and any intrinsic variation in the color luminosity of the supernovae. There are many methods to do this, none of which I'm really going to go into in any detail. These are the five principal ways. What we can say about them all is that they tend to give very similar precision on distance estimates. And after you make corrections based on these different techniques, you get a precision in distance to about 7%, or about 0.13, 0.14 magnitudes. And so you go from a standard candle of 20% precision to one of 7%, which is a huge improvement. So these are the type of Hubble diagrams. So we saw some of these this morning. These are just two at random. This is from Jarre et al. And Prieto et al. and you can see that you get, it doesn't matter which technique you use, you tend to get similar dispersions and similar precision on the type 1A supernovae. So that's how we use them. Now I'm going to talk about the supernova legacy survey. This is a five-year high redshift supernova survey that we're doing at the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope. This is the CFHT. This is the MegaCam, or MegaPrime, instrument, a 36 CCD camera, which sits up here at the prime focus. And we do a rolling search where we observe the same patches of sky continuously, well, except when the moon is up, to find and follow distant type 1A supernovae. And we do this in four filters for good K corrections and color measurements of the supernovae. This is where the data comes from. So these are the, this is the imaging data. So this is our typical kind of light curve and supernovae. All of the imaging comes from CFHT. We then, once we've found the objects, we send them for spectroscopy at 8 to 10 meter class telescopes. Most of the time comes from Gemini North and South and the VLT, about 240 hours a year between them. And then we have some supplementary time at Keck. And we've been using Magellan to do some host-galaxy studies. So there's a lot of data that comes into this project. The current status, we've been running for 3.5 years out of the 5 years, and we have around 300 confirmed distant supernovae, which is well, it's certainly the largest single telescope sample of high redshift supernovae, and we're on track for about 500 spectroscopically confirmed supernovae by the end of the survey, with about 2,000 light curves of supernovae in total. Of course, 1,500 of those we won't get spectra for. For the 1As, this is the N of Z, and you see it's fairly flat out to about a redshift of 0.8 or 0.9. When we put that together, we can do the cosmology. This is the SNLS first year cosmology. It was based on around 70 high redshift supernovae. So these points here are the SNLS supernovae. This is the low redshift sample, and these are the residuals from the best fit. The distance estimator that we used was kind of a regression analysis. It used the SALT light curve fitter, and then the SALT outputs the stretch and the color. And when we do the cosmology, we fit for these alpha and these beta parameters, which parameterize the effects of stretch and color on the supernova luminosities. When you put it all together, the first year result was omega matter of about 0.26 and W consistent with minus 1 at the 9% level. We now have moved on. We've made the third year Hubble diagram. So this is now 250 high redshift supernovae with a completely independent analysis and a calibration path to ASTI et al. 2006. So there's now 250 high redshift supernovae up here. And these are the residuals from an omega matter 0.26 fit in a flat universe. The blues show that the mean residuals as a function of redshift. And then these are two comparison cosmologies. This is Einstein de Sitter. And then this is a low matter open universe. And you can see when we look in terms of the equation of state of dark energy W and omega matter, these are the contours. And we end up with around a 7% measure of W. W is very similar to the first year number, very close to minus 1, at about the 7% level. So we're currently, in a measure of W, we're currently at about 7% for the SNLS. So, oh, and then coming soon, we're looking at W as a function of scale factor, W in non-flat universes, working in more external constraints, such as the full WMAP 3 with Cosmo MC, and then some high redshift supernovae, and that's work in progress. But I want to spend the rest of the talk, which is about 10 more minutes, looking at some of the host galaxy correlations that we're finding in SNLS and some of the more recent results. So we've seen a lot about host galaxies at this conference and how they impact over properties and the light curve shape. And this is, you know, these kind of relations have been known for some time, since the mid-90s for this one. So this shows delta M15 as a function of the galaxy type. And this is a compilation from Hamoy et al. 2000. There are many other compilations in the literature. And what we know, we see, is that for low-stretch supernovae, these are the faint, high delta M15, low-stretch, preferentially exploding ellipticals and S0 galaxies, whereas the high-stretch supernovae, the brighter ones, tend to exclusively, well, almost exclusively explode in late-type spirals. When you look at Hubble diagrams broken by host galaxy type, you tend to see that the supernovae and ellipticals show this smaller scatter. They seem to be a cleaner cosmological probe. This is data from the SCP from 2003. So in legacy, oh yeah, so here's the exclusion. We don't find any of these supernovae, these bright supernovae in early type galaxies. So in SNLS, we've been doing host galaxies, so we don't have any morphologies, so we don't have HST imaging, so we can't do the kind of analysis you can do in the local universe. So instead, we do broadband SED fitting for the galaxies using a code called PEGAS-2, and Chris talked briefly about this morning. So we fit the galaxy SEDs, UGRIZ photometry, and we get synthetic photometry from the PEGAS templates, and when we fit the SEDs, we get estimates of the star formation rates, the mass, and the mean age of the stellar populations, and then we can classify the host galaxies according to their physical parameters rather than the morphological what they look like approach. And so this should tell you something a little bit more physical about the host galaxies. And then this is what we saw this morning as well. This is the when we put it all together and calculate the rates as a function of the specific star formation rate, we see this dramatic increase in the rate of supernovae in later type galaxies. The supernovae are around an order of magnitude or more common in these vigorously star-forming galaxies. And really, this specific star formation rate can be thought of as a morphology with late-type irregulars, early-type spirals, and ellipticals down here. But that's not all. The real thing of interest is that the stretch of the supernova correlates with the host galaxy type at all. And so this is now an updated analysis from the paper we wrote last year. So this is the stretch distribution in star-forming galaxies in SNLS and passive galaxies in SNLS. And you can see that the arrow, which points to the mean of the two distributions, is really quite different. The distributions are obviously different, and of course you have many more supernovae in these star-forming galaxies. You can look at it another way. What plus in here is the supernova stretch again against the mean age of the stellar population in giga-years. So this is about a giga-year old, this is 10 giga-years, and this is 100 million years. And you can see that it's not exactly a trend, but it's more an area of the plot where there are a very few supernovae, and bearing in mind some of the error bars on these points are quite big, and so this point is consistent with being almost anywhere along here. But what we do find is that there are no low-stretch supernovae in these young stellar populations. And so, the inescapable conclusion, well, firstly, the majority of type 1a supernovae come from young stellar populations. I think that's pretty obvious from this plot. But not only that, but the stretch obviously correlates with the stretch of the supernova obviously correlates with the age of the progenitor population. So what does this mean? Well, what we can do now is we can make a prediction as to how, bearing in mind that the stretch seems to correlate with the age of the stellar population, we can make a prediction as to how the stretch might change with redshift. So this is redshift along this axis. So this is the local universe. This is age in billions of years. And this is the two-component model. So this is A plus B model that we no longer think is right, apparently. But anyway, it's the same whether you use A plus B or whether you use more realistic kind of distributions for the delay time. What you end up with is a component. This component of old supernovae, as mass builds up in the universe, this component gets more importance. And then this other component, this young component that follows star formation. And so when you put the two together, you get quite a shallow evolution in the combined supernova rates. But if you think that the stretch is going to correlate with these two components, you can see that the mean stretch is going to change as a function of redshift. And so we can go and test that in the various supernova samples that are published. And so this is work by Andy Howe, that's on AstroPH. And there are three supernova samples here. This is the nearby supernova sample. This is the SNLS sample to redshift 0.75. which is where we think we understand our completeness accurately. And then this is the VSET-L sample at redshift greater than 1. And when we construct the mean stretches, we see a kind of drift so the arrows here point at the mean stretch in each of these redshift bins, and you can see this drift in the mean stretch. Overplotted, those Gaussians you see at the solid lines are the predicted evolution from the simple A plus B plus the SNLS stretch distribution. And so, it looks that we have a tentative detection for this stretch evolution. So this means that the average stretch of the supernova is going to change with redshift. And so the average intrinsic brightness of the supernova will also evolve. But of course, if the stretch correction works perfectly, this shouldn't affect the cosmology if you assume that the stretch works equally well across environment and redshift. Okay, so we just started to look at this. So I hoped I'd have the actual result to show you here, but I can show you something preliminary. So this is now the SNLS sample, but this time it's split. So this is the residuals from the Hubble diagram, the best fit cosmology, this time split according to the type of host galaxy. And so in the top panel, this is the passive galaxies, which were typed as I explained earlier, and then these are the star-forming, supernovae and star-forming host galaxies. And I think, well, firstly, what do we see? Well, we see that there's probably less dispersion in this passive sample. I think that's what you might expect if you think dust is the main contributor to the scatter. The intrinsic dispersion in these supernovae is around 0.1 magnitudes compared to 0.16 in the spirals. But we are seeing similar, this alpha, which parameterizes the stretch, luminosity correction, is very similar across environments. And we don't see any evidence at the moment that it's changing from galaxy type to galaxy type. But it is early days. What we do see is that there's this hint that this beta parameter is going to be different. It seems to be smaller in the passive galaxies and larger in the star-forming galaxies, which is what you might expect if you think in the passive galaxies you've mostly got an intrinsic color-luminosity relationship, and then in the star-forming galaxies you have the intrinsic relationship plus some amount of dust. But as I say, this is early days for this. So the last thing I want to show is the mean spectrum of type 1a supernovae. So this is more SNLS work, but this time this is done in collaboration with Richard Ellis at Caltech. And we did intensive or high signal to noise spectroscopy of SNLS supernovae at intermediate redshifts. And so the idea was that we'd be able to probe this part of the spectrum here, short with a rest frame 36 or 3500 angstroms, which is very hard to do in the local universe because the UV gets absorbed by the atmosphere, so you have to go to space and there's no real good space facility anymore to do this kind of work. So we did this. This has taken 3 or 4 years of quite hard work, and I've got around 14 spectra at maximum light and an equal number about a week prior to maximum light, so this is just the maximum light comparison I'm showing you. The mean spectrum from SNLS is this black line, and the grey area is like the error, the bootstrapped resample populations, the error in the mean spectrum. And then the red line is the Nugent et al. Local template. So that is constructed purely from redshift zero or close to zero supernovae. And so what I would say is that the agreement is actually very good indeed. In this part of the spectrum, in the B band, where the supernovae are standard candles, it's remarkably good. So there's really no evidence at all for evolution to redshift 0.5 here. There are some other interesting differences. Maybe the silicon is deeper, or maybe some of these UV features have shifted. But I think it's fair to say that the high redshift data is probably of higher quality than the low redshift data. I think in the Nugent template, there's only 2 or 3 supernovae down here. So I think what we can say is that within the error bars, I think the spectra are quite consistent, and there's no real evidence for any evolution in the UV for the supernovae to redshift half. Nearly the last slide. So the other thing we've done with the data is to construct a mean spectra, this time split by stretch. And I'm not sure how well this comes out, but the blue line on here is the high stretch, the brighter supernovae from SNLS at redshift 0.5, and then the red is the low stretch mean spectrum at redshift 0.5. And this time we do seem to see some differences. So for example, the shape of the continuum is different, but you might expect that anyway because there's known relationships between stretch and color. But more interestingly, and I think we saw some of this work yesterday as well, but it's the same kind of thing. We're seeing more silicon in the low stretch supernovae. I think there's more calcium in the low stretch supernovae as well. And so this is fine, except if you think there's some kind of stretch evolution, then when you come to do precision cosmology, if the mean stretch is changing, this also means that the mean spectrum is changing as well. And so when you do cosmology in the future, you have to be very careful that you are using the right kind of spectrum as a function of redshift to correct for these effects. And so that's basically it. To leave you with the future prospects with SNLS. We're currently at this 7% level measurement of W. It's consistent with -1. And at the survey end, we expect a 4 to 5% statistical uncertainty with all these external constraints. And I think it's clear that the progenitor age is playing an important factor affecting the stretch, and the stretch seems to depend on the host galaxy star formation rate and age, but I don't think there's a clear idea as to why. And also it looks as though the supernovae and passive galaxies appear to be better standard candles. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
The Hubble diagram that you drew in with the SCP data several years ago, you did it individually for early type galaxies, and then you got a omega lambda that was somewhat lower than for the others. Have you done this kind of exercise here?
Oh yeah. So in the SCP sample, excuse me, there was no correction for dust extinction on the SCP sample because they didn't have the data quality to do that. And so, you know, you might expect that the supernovae and spirals would be slightly fainter. We have done the analysis with a new data set with Legacy, and the results are consistent with each other within the error bars. But you know, I can't really say more than that because it's still kind of early. But they're consistent. The measurement of W is consistent.
And another brief question, if I may. In your Hubble diagram, the first one you showed, the error bars suddenly jump up at above redshift 0.8. Why is that?
Oh, that's because this one? Well, that's because at the highest redshift.
Oh, the previous one actually showed it more clearly.
Oh, yeah, well, that's okay. So
here,
in the first year, so up here at a redshift of 0.9, in order to measure the rest frame U and rest frame B, you rely on the Z filter at CFHT, which has a lower signal to noise and a lower throughput. The supernovae are fainter, and it's hard to get the observations in Z. In the first year, the Z observations were quite shallow, and so the signal to noise on those points was quite small. In the third year analysis, we increased the exposure times, and so you know, that has helped our error bars up at redshift 1.
You showed us that as you go to higher redshift, you see supernovae that are, on average, brighter. And of course, you would expect that as a matter of selection as well.
Sure.
So can you say a little bit about how you've modeled the selection and why the effect that you showed us in the histograms should be attributed to a real effect rather than to selection?
I'll answer the question. Andy can step in as well because it's his work. But in SNLS, to redshift 0.75, our simulations show that we recover, there's very little bias in the stretch. So we can construct the mean stretch drift as a function of redshift. I don't have the plot, but 0.75 is more or less where there's very little drift at all. In the highest redshift sample, the resettle, we just go based on what is in the literature. And I think maybe Adam can comment, but I think they believe that they're fairly complete in that stretch range or delta M15 at those redshifts. Right. Yeah. Now, I mean, it could still be a selection effect, but in some sense, it doesn't matter for the cosmology whether it's a selection effect or not. The effect is still there. So.
Adam?
So you showed that for the two samples, the passive and the star forming, that you had two different betas, this color correction term. And I mean, it makes sense from the standpoint of you described.
Yep.
One where you have the passive and you don't have much dust, you're having something that's close to the intrinsic supernova physics related cause of color and luminosity relation. In the star forming, you probably have a mixture of the two. Then in the Howell work that you showed, the demographics are changing as a function of redshift. So this seems like a very bad thing then in the cosmology to use a single value of beta at low redshift and high redshift when a single value of beta doesn't work for both groups and the mixture of the two groups is changing as a function of redshift.
Well, I would agree. Yeah, I think it's clear you can do better by trying to separate out the two effects, and that's one of the reasons we're going to explore the MLCS 2K2 code, which you know, attempts to do that.
But I guess I'm sort of wondering, like in the present results you have, it almost seems like that has to create an offset right now. I mean, you have a different mixture. They have their own different beta values. I guess I'd be surprised if these results don't change.
You mean the cosmology? Well, okay, but the absolute magnitude of the supernova will change as well. I mean, the whole thing is correlated.
Right, but the size of corrections you will make will be different at low redshift than at high redshift.
On average to the population, because of the differences in stretch, you mean?
Because of the different because of the different beta values that they should, you know, that each group should have.
I don't see why that would. I don't think it'll be a big effect as a function of redshift, though. I mean.
Well, I guess you'll have to see quantitatively. Yeah.
Could you just put back the 1A volume rate as a function of redshift? Because it went by fast. I was trying to remember. Again, it comes to this M dot normalization, which you were getting to be different than Minucci. So I think, okay, so maybe Adam's going to talk about this, but I guess the problem Evan and I had is, of course, we missed the redshift 1.5 point, but that's because we were using Minucci et al.'s M dot normalization, so our curves were higher.
Sure.
So can you tell us a little bit about I guess your point is the one solid point,
so,
as they say.
Yeah. So this, This solid point is the SNLS redshift 0.5 volumetric rates. Now, if you take a star formation history and you have a higher, the value of B that you had in the Scanner-Piecko paper, in fact, you predict a volumetric rate that was above this point here. But I don't see how you can increase the B number too much without, you know, contradicting the observations. But we shouldn't be surprised because our A's and B's were derived from the same data that derived this solid point. So right. High redshift, I think Adam is going to talk about that. And I'm surprised there aren't more at high redshift.
I guess the comment I have, or the question, or maybe a request, is that as you saw yesterday, sort of all of the physical modeling going on in light curves of spectra is in terms of delta M15, and I asked Andy Howell this yesterday or 2 days ago, which is that for many of us we'd love to know how to map from stretch to delta M15.
Oh, yeah.
Should we actually want to do any physics with these data?
Mm-hmm.
So my request is that somehow in these papers you make it clear how to get from stretch to delta M15 so that one can actually map this beautiful data set to all of the theoretical modeling that's happening.
I think that's one of the reasons that in the third year paper we plan to test different light curve fitters which will produce stretches or deltas or...
No, sorry, it's very simple in the sense that...
I'm not even sure it's a one-to-one relationship. No, I mean...
So I think the main point I would like to make is that in the absence of you doing that, there's no way the theoretical community, as far as I have yet to see it, can take these and ask about, for example, iron production or nickel production as a function of redshift or all of these questions. It's difficult to do with these distributions.
They can't predict stretches for supernovae.
Something. Peak luminosity, some observable quantity.
Well, the peak luminosities are in the paper. I mean, they're always there.
There is a relation between stretch and luminosity that is just the alpha parameter. So,
well, alpha, as you would observe more supernova, your best fit alpha will change. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And when you do the cosmological fit, the alpha and the beta are correlated with the cosmological parameters at some level. It's important to include that.
The simple formula is delta M15 equals 3 minus 2 times the stretch. That's the simple first order formula.
Well, Andy, should maybe clarify why I'm not allowed to use that.
They don't use the same stretch. SNLS doesn't use the same stretch as the SCP, so you have still another thing.
Right, that's what I was going to say, is that it every time we fit with a different template, it changes the definition of stretch. So you have to use whichever one we used in whatever paper. So. But the same thing is true for delta M15. Delta M15 is not actually really delta M15. It's template fitting as well, so you need to know their templates.
Quick question. You said that you used the Pegas models to derive the host properties.
Yeah.
And I assume that you must have spectra of some of these host galaxies as well. And are the properties you derive from the spectra consistent with the values you derive from the photometrically based models?
Mostly, yes. The spectroscopic type of the galaxy correlates with the specific star formation rates. But we don't have spectra of the hosts that are good enough, because they're contaminated by the supernova, to measure star formation rates and parameters like that. But in general, if it's got emission lines, it will be one in our star-forming group, and if it hasn't, it will be in our passive group. That's kind of the level that the split is at the moment.
Okay, thanks, Mark. The next speaker is